Hello, I'm Andy Burnham. Welcome to this week's Sparks. Classic FM come on air in the form of six low-power test stations. Today we've got a preview, but what chance does it have in the current radio environment? And a look at classical radio in America, complete with compression and reverberation. Hum a tune down the phone to your local library and they might think you a bit strange. In Birmingham, they positively encourage it. PAL Plus side panel research is abandoned and NHK in Japan broadcast HD TV, but who's watching? And a look at TV sets, old and new. Steer-by-wire cars, Pirate FM, and Sinking Venice. That's all in this week's Sparks from Radio Facts. You can hear us on 3910 6205 and 12255.
Evangeline, Evangeline, Evangeline. radio and finds it 252 and love comes to town. Good morning to you. It's 8:13, Charlie Wolf in the morning, and this is the neatest thing in the world they have at the Birmingham Library. It's the Hum Line. If there's a song you don't know, you can call up the library, and they will figure out the song for you. On the line this morning, say good morning to John Goff. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
From the Birmingham Hum Line, huh?
Yes.
Tell me, now, who set this thing up? Whose idea was this?
Well, I think it was one of those good ideas that was sort of in the air.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people who work in music libraries are used to these sort of inquiries anyway. We have people who come in off the streets and sing at us across our counters because they woke up this morning with a tune in their minds and they don't know what it is, or they can only remember half of it, can't quite sort of remember how to go and find out the other half. So,
Let me just ask you, what kind of music is it usually that they're ringing in with? Are we talking pop?
Absolutely all sorts. We've had almost 800 calls now since the service was set up about 3 weeks ago.
Amazing.
And it's absolutely across the board. In the main, I suppose, it's sort of people who've heard, especially classical pieces, on TV commercials, and they're really keen to go and buy the record or borrow it from the library.
Actually, funny enough, that's the thing. I know sometimes you'll hear something, and or you remember an old classical tune, and you just don't, the titles aren't as exciting as they have in pop music, are they?
No.
Fourth, fifth, opus 3, 22, E minor, who can remember all that sort of stuff? So, like, if someone rang in and they went, you'd say?
Beethoven's Fifth Symphony.
No, actually, I was thinking it was part of the 1812 Overture.
Oh, well, you didn't sing the right bit, I promise.
Now, do you have problems? What if someone's not the best hummer in the world? Do you have trouble tracking down some of these songs?
Oh, well, yes, we're not 100% successful, but we're about 80%, we reckon, so far. And the way that it works is that because we're a very large library in Birmingham, we have 15 staff in the music library. And as I say, we've been used to doing this sort of thing for quite a while, but all we've done now is put it on a telephone line with an answering machine. So when the calls come in, we play them back when there's some staff about in the hope that someone will recognise it, because our staff come from all sorts of different musical backgrounds. We've got people who are really heavily into current chart stuff, and other people who like classical music, and people who like jazz. So if someone can recognise it straight away, then there's the inquiry solved. But if not, then we have to go away and write the tune down and do the research.
You ring back for more information if it's needed. Sometimes we do that with pop songs. You said it goes to the male singer. Can you get?
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, often the people who ring up sort of say, I can't quite remember how this goes, but I remember it was a hit in 1972, and it was about the desert.
What's the most difficult one you've had? It comes to mind.
Oh dear. I can't quite remember. I mean, I've concentrated on the popular ones sort of in my mind, but the best one I think is someone from the Australian Embassy in Paris who wrote to us saying that they had this Peter Gregorian chant they wanted identifying because they wanted to buy a record, and fortunately we weren't able to find that. So it can be really obscure. It's a matter of luck, really, as to how much detail people give us that provides the clue to us solving the riddle.
Right. Who's paying for all this? Is this just part of the library's expense, or?
Well, they're part of the ordinary inquiries that we would have in a library anyway. The particular reason that we've set it up is that Birmingham is the UK City of Music for 1992. It's part of the library's activity as part of that to publicise our services. Because a lot of people don't realise what services are available to them from their local libraries, because libraries are about information, and we've got staff at every library who help people find that information.
Great. So tell me, what is the Hum Line number?
Okay, well, it's 021 for Birmingham, 236-6692.
Alrighty. And your specialty would be what area of music?
Mine?
Yeah. Wasn't classical.
Yes, classical music. Classical music about, I suppose, progressive rock of the 70s, 60s and 70s, jazz.
What about this one? It's the only one that comes to mind. This should be easy.
That's Elvis Presley, Wooden Heart.
Very good. Very good. Thank you, John Goff at the Birmingham Library Hum Line this morning. That's an excellent service. That's long overdue. Good luck with it.
All right, thanks very much.
All righty. It's 8:17. Andrew has an update. He'll hum it for you. Coming up next, Longwave Radio, Atlantic 252.
Apologies for the poor quality of the report, but I thought you'd be interested to hear that anyway. So the Hum Line number again, if you missed it, is 021-236-6692, which will connect you to Birmingham Library for you to hum your tune to them. Here's a letter that Mr. D.W.R. Dobson has written to his MP on our behalf. As a keen radio listener, I have for many years been listening to shortwave broadcasts from all over the world. In 1988, I started listening to a station called Radio Fax, which was broadcasting from the Republic of Ireland, but was owned and operated by an English company based in Surrey. This station closed down in December 1988, in company with the other unlicensed stations in the Republic. Radio Fax is now back on air from a location in Southern Ireland. I understand from them that they have applied for a license to broadcast on shortwave only from a site in the UK, but have been refused, as it would appear that it is not government policy to grant HF broadcasting licenses to any organisation other than the BBC. Whilst I'm a great admirer of the BBC and do not dispute that they do a splendid job with their overseas broadcasts, I feel that it is somewhat incongruous that the present government, of which you are a member, does not allow private enterprise broadcasting to extend to the shortwave bands. The UK airwaves are full of new radio stations, the majority of which have appeared during the past 10 years following legislation and active encouragement from the government. Radio Fax is not yet another radio jukebox like most of the legal stations. They broadcast a varied programme of serious topics, news from the broadcasting world, and differing music to suit all tastes. From their mailbag, they obviously have a worldwide audience and are an excellent alternative voice for this country. I would ask that you use your influence within the government to promote a change in the regulations so that properly managed and technically equipped stations could be licensed for shortwave broadcasting from locations within this country. If these changes were made, then I'm sure the image of Great Britain projected abroad can only be enhanced. And he recommends his MP to tune into Radio Fax. Well, hello to Michael Jopling, if you're listening. And the reply is the stock one with a new sentence. I'm copying this letter to the chief executive of the Radio Communications Authority because of his responsibilities for spectrum planning. The letter was replied to by Peter Lloyd from the Home Office. On to a letter from Professor John Campbell. I guess that the efforts to get some kind of licensed or official status can't have a fixed timetable, and you have simply to keep on pushing until something may eventually happen. E.g., might happen faster in Ireland than here. I hope to restart the unofficial radio contributions that I used to make to Media Network on the World Service of Radio Netherlands soon. I haven't done anything for the last 2 years or so because my timetable has been complicated by all the excitement in Eastern Europe and places further east during that time. But things look like being more predictable now. Overall, the signal quality was excellent, and this was almost the way to describe the quality of reception, too. He's listening on a Sony ICF 7600 receiver with a telescopic antenna about 40 centimetres long. All the best for the continued success of your broadcasting. Well, thanks to Professor John Campbell for that letter. And if you've got any comments about the programmes, then please write to Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. Always happy to have your opinions, and if you'd like a station card, which includes technical information about the transmitter site and an artist's impression, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1. The address, Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG.
John was quizzical, studied metaphysical science in the home. Late nights all alone with a test tube. Oh, oh, oh. Maxwell Edison, majoring in medicine, calls her on the phone. Can I take you out to the pictures, John? On the door. Bang, bang, Maxwell's silver hammer came down upon her head. Bang, bang, Maxwell's silver hammer made sure that she was dead. Back in school again, Maxwell plays the fool again. Teacher wishing to avoid an unpleasant scene. She tells Max to stay when the glass has gone away, so he waits behind. Writing 50 times, I must not be so, oh, oh. But when she turns her back on the boy, he creeps up from behind. Bang, bang, Maxwell sailed on. Maxwell stands alone, painting testimonial pictures. Oh, 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 oh. Rose and Valerie screaming from the gallery say he must go free.
Maxwell must go free.
The judge does not agree, and he tells them so. Oh, oh, oh. But as the words are leaving his lips, a noise comes from behind.
In international broadcasting, the UK abandons PAL Plus side panel research. Engineers in the UK have abandoned attempts to stitch side panels onto the proposed widescreen PAL Plus system. The decision means that the UK will now fall into line with the rest of Eureka PAL Plus project and propose that existing 4:3 format television sets display the controversial letterbox-shaped image. That is, with a black band at top and bottom of your screens. Until now, TV engineers had hoped to be able to add data to either side of a 4:3 ratio picture to make up a 16:9 image. This would have allowed a 4:3 set to show a normal PAL image, with a widescreen PAL Plus receiver showing the full widescreen picture. But creating a system that seamlessly adds on the so-called side panels has proved impossible. Within the time frame foreseen for the introduction of widescreen PAL services from 1995 onwards, the side panel approach is no longer considered to be a viable option. Paul Gardiner, principal engineer at the UK's Independent Television Commission, told a conference on widescreen PAL at London's Institute of Electrical Engineers. Gardiner also explained that although overcoming the technical problems in adding side panels can probably be overcome, the resultant complexity of receiver processing has been shown to be very considerable. This would add inordinate expense to consumer receivers. We have reached a point where people are seeing that the technical problems are really quite severe, said Mick Gleave, Deputy Engineering Information Officer at the BBC. The difficulty is that the side panels are on a different channel and the join must be invisible. It's too difficult to do. There have been demonstrations, but the robustness of such systems has been dubious. He explained that excursions from non-ideal transmission conditions affected the visibility of the side panel stitching. The right way of proceeding is with letterbox. It's the most likely scenario. The BBC is not doing any work on side panels. Most, if not all, side panel research in the UK was performed at NTL on behalf of the Independent Television Commission, where computer simulations were used to model possible encoding systems for the 16:9, 625, 50Hz progressive scan PAL Plus system. According to Richard Ellis, chief engineer at Granada Television and chairman of the IEEE conference, the only side panel research now being undertaken is at David Sarnoff Labs in the United States. Sarnoff's EDTV system is a side-panelled NTSC-compatible system. With Letterbox PAL Plus now seemingly accepted, UK broadcasters on the PAL Plus steering group are proposing that a compromise letterbox technique called windowing is employed for some time on 4-3 sets prior to PAL Plus transmissions to get viewers used to the slim picture format. Windowing with a 14-9 format has been proposed. That was International Broadcasting.
You're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts. Every Monday and Tuesday, it's our look at science, media and technology news. Classic FM, the new national independent station, are currently transmitting a series of test stations, running on low power as special event stations. On 101.6 FM, they are originally titled Radio 101.6 FM, and transmit from Coventry, South Manchester, Durham, Bath, Edinburgh and Teddington in southeast London. Here's half an hour of their typical output condensed down into a few minutes for you to listen to.
The first movement of Beethoven's dramatic Symphony No. 5, played for us there by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Sir George Scholte. And if you'd like to get hold of that particular version, it's on the Decca label. In a moment, some musical consolation for today's sporting losers. At 5:15, this is Radio 101.6 FM.
Find that Spiller's Prime is full of succulent, meaty pieces. Prime meat. Instinct leads to it.
Radio 101.6 FM, your classic choice. Luciano Pavarotti, Nessun Dorma Puccini on the Decca label. And before that, we heard Franz Liszt's Consolation, played by Van Cliburn. This is Radio 101.6 FM. Good evening, I'm Tony Hawkins. And now a brief look at the sporting headlines today. Manchester United stay top of Division 1 in spite of only drawing 0-0 at Coventry. Leeds narrowed the gap to just 2 points, beating Luton Town. And Liverpool drew 0-0 against Southampton. And the Birmingham City-Stoke City match suffered a major pitch invasion in the final minute of the game. The game seemed to have been abandoned, but the final minute was played half an hour later. The result, a 1-1 draw. I thought it was meant to be sport. And I guess league leaders Manchester United could have done with the Sorcerer's Apprentice earlier this afternoon, following their cartoon performance at Coventry City. A Mickey Mouse performance? Well, perhaps not. At 5:25, it's time for another classic choice. Sorcerer's Apprentice at 5:35. This is 101.6 FM, your classic choice. Now, if you're in London and you're looking for something to fill your evening with this very evening, there are one or two events that are on, and I think tickets are still available. And Small and Solemn at St. Martin in the Fields at 7:30. Not quite sure what that means. Tickets between £6 and £10 for this concert. It's another Rossini birthday junket, yet another one, I'm afraid. This one is his Petite Messe Solennelle from Leon Lovett and the English Baroque Choir. Well, I don't know about Small and Solemn. Who thinks up these rather pretentious titles? After all, it's just darn good music. Here's something solemn and rather small. was Waltz in C sharp minor, opus 64, number 2, played by Dino Lipati, and preceding Chopin, Dvorak's Song to the Moon from Rusalka, played by the legendary Black Dyke Mills Band. Now, later this evening and on Sunday evening, I'll be presenting Radio 101.6 FM's Classic Concert, brought to you in association with TWA. And tonight we'll be featuring music from Handel, Beethoven and Berlioz, whilst tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock we've a Chopin recital come concert with Claudio Arrau. Well, you may be interested to know that Radio 101.6 FM is a test service. We're trying out a mix of popular classical music for you to enjoy and to think about. Too much Chopin? Not enough Bizet? Can't get a handle on our music? Well, later this year, Britain's first national commercial classical music station comes on air. And this is a test designed to aid us in our music policy making. Give us a ring with your opinions on 0800 277 772 with your thoughts on what we're about. Or you can write to us at Radio 101.6 FM, Piccadilly Plaza, Manchester, M14AW. Right, our classic choice continues in a moment in military mood with some Yankee Doodle Dandy.
Are you in love with classic love songs? Dino presents Love for Sale.
Radio 101.6 FM. Your classic choice.
Was my next door neighbour switching something on at the end, giving you an idea of just how low power these stations are. I'm only 6 miles away from one of the transmitters. As you heard, it's a test broadcast, and they're seeking audience reaction. Personally, I didn't like the compression. Maybe you thought the presenter was too great to be with you today, etc. Now's the time to complain, or just call in with your favourite composers to help them get the playlist together. The free phone number is 0800 277 772. That's 0800 277 772. Or write to Radio 101.6 FM, Piccadilly Plaza, Manchester, M14AW. Well, Trevor thinks it's going to do an airport information radio and fail, but let's wish the station luck. Even ending up playing classical middle-of-the-road trash is better than pop trash or gold trash. What do you think? So give them some audience reaction and maybe shape how they come on the air.
Two short items here in The Guardian. The end of Radio 3's medium-wave broadcasts clears the frequency for the second of the National Commercial Radio Licences, INR2, due to be awarded in April or May. While Radio 3 fans fume this summer about 32 days of cricket disrupting regular programmes, Test Match Special will be shifted to Radio 3 FM. The suspicion is that the medium wave frequency might in fact lie idle. The highest bidder for the new station, INBC, gives a start date of May 1993. And in Radio World, about radio in the previous Soviet Union. Pirate radio stations broadcast across the band from the old Soviet Union. The rock music of Belomor Canal is between 1605 kHz and 1820 kHz, along with Syndicat Agat, Orbit, Cardinal, and System. A second set of pirates operate from 2000 to 2400 kHz, with such names as Balder Ivanova, Ducat, Colossa, Exotique, and Mirage. And now, some pirates also use the Western International Pirate Radio Wave Band of 48 metres. More indications there of how radio is more liberal in Russia than it is in England, from Radio World.
For millions worldwide who listen each week on live radio to the Metropolitan Opera from the Lincoln Center in New York, the ears of J. David Sachs are key to their interpretation of each broadcast performance. A veteran producer of classical and Broadway soundtrack recordings, Sachs each week faces the challenge of pleasing listeners ranging from audio purists with exotic sound systems to buffs with tiny portables. How do you approach an opera broadcast for radio, he was first asked. Well, it's live. Once you start, you can't stop. It's not like a recording session, where if you don't like what you have, you can call a halt to the proceedings and make adjustments. And because it's a live performance in front of a paying audience, you can't place microphones everywhere you would like. If I didn't have an audience, I'd place the microphones in some significantly different places. What about processing? With radio, we use compression. For me, there are two pairs of limiters which are essential. There's a pair for vocals. A lot of opera singers have voices with huge peaks which come out on certain notes and then drop back down again to a very low level. They have a tendency to get swamped by an orchestra, or they force us to have the general level setting rather low to accommodate the peaks. We limit the entire mix of the vocal microphones first, and that comes out of the stereo mix. Then we combine it with the orchestra and the ambience together. That combination of orchestra, ambience, and compressed vocals goes through yet another pair of compressors for an overall compression. You also add reverb with Lexicon. Without it, Sachs replies, the house would sound dry. The pit itself is dry and the microphones are close in there. The stage is dry as well. I found that without adding artificial reverb, it has that kind of dead newsreel quality. We carefully set up the reverb to bring a little more life, a little more depth, and a little more detail. Purists will argue that we are not presenting the real Met. That argument means nothing to me. The minute the sound goes through the microphone, it's subject to the mix. I don't regard this as some kind of scandal that we are adding reverb. It simply makes the sound better. So, that's J. David Sachs's opinion on broadcasting classical radio, and it seems that Classic FM in Britain agree with him on certain points. They've certainly limited their classical music output on these low-power stations quite considerably. Is this a good way to be going for classical music broadcasting? Well, you can write and tell me your reactions, or you can phone up the Classic FM hotline and complain direct to them. It's Sparks on Radio Facts. And hello to Keith Townsend, who wrote the article about us in Radioactive magazine. I'm indeed most interested in the continuing correspondence between yourself and the DTI regarding Radio Facts. I wish you and your colleagues every success for the future. I remain convinced that you have an excellent case for the granting of a licence and a properly authorised operating frequency, and given recent international developments, I do not believe the UK government can keep up its King Canute impression indefinitely. Well, that's Keith Townsend writing, and he was also very active in getting citizens' band radio legalised in the UK. So he's talking of someone with some experience in these matters.
Even if I am in love with you, all this to say would speak to you. Observe the blood, the rose tattoo of the fingerprints on me from you. Other evidence has shown that you and I are still alone. We skirt around the danger zone and don't talk about it late. Marlena watches from the wall. Her mocking smile says it all. She records the rise and fall of every soldier passing. But the only soldier now is me. I'm fighting things I cannot see. I think it's called my destiny that I am changing. Marlena on the wall. Well, I walk to your house in the afternoon by the butcher shop with a sawdust room. Don't give away the goods too soon is what she might have told me. And I tried so hard to resist when you held me in your handsome fist and reminded me of the night we kissed and of why I should be leaving. Marlena watches from the wall. Her mocking smile says it all. She records the rise and fall of every soldier passing. But the only soldier now is me. I'm fighting things I cannot see. I think it's called my destiny that I am changing. Marlena on the wall. Marlena watches from the wall. Her mocking smile says it all. The rise and fall of every soldier passing. But the only soldier now is me. I'm fighting things I cannot see. I think it's called my destiny that I am changing. Marlena on the wall. And even if I am in love with you, all this to say, what's it to you? Observe the blood, the rose tattoo of the fingerprints on me from you. Other evidence has shown that you and I are still alone. We skirt around the danger zone and don't talk about it later. And I tried so hard to resist when you held me in your handsome fist and reminded me of the night we kissed and of why I should be leaving. Marlena watches from the wall. Her mocking smile says it all. She records the rise and fall of every man who's been here. But the only one here now is me. I'm fighting things I cannot see. I think it's called my destiny that I am changing, 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 changing. Marlena watches from the wall. Her mocking smile says it all as she records the rise and fall of every soldier passing. But the only soldier now is me. I'm fighting things I cannot see. I think it's called my destiny that I am changing. Marlena on the wall.
Classic FM radio station may flop by Maggie Brown. Classic FM, Britain's first national commercial radio channel, which is expected to start this autumn, could flop in a manner similar to that of the original high-minded Mission to Explain TV AM breakfast programme, according to advertisers. Lynn Robinson, an executive with the agency Leo Burnett, told a conference on the new face of radio that the first national franchise should have gone to an extremely popular service which would have raised the profile of the whole industry. Instead, the Radio Authority, constrained by the government's Broadcasting Act, gave it to one of the most minority interests. It will probably struggle to survive. She also said that the debacle over its award, first to the highest bidder, Showtime Radio, which could not raise the finance, and then to the runner-up, Classic, had done nothing to assist the fortunes and public perception of commercial radio. Charles Gallican, head of advertising for the Health Education Authority, which uses radio advertisements extensively for spreading warnings about AIDS and smoking among young people, said that while a classic music service might attract new listeners, he wondered whether it would be another TVAM. There is a question over its viability. Commercial radio is suffering from the advertising recession and its failure to attract the big blue-chip advertisers such as Procter & Gamble, Birds Eye Foods and Rover. It has seen its share of total advertising remain static at about 2% in the past decade, despite a huge expansion in the number of stations. Advertisers told the scores of commercial radio station managers attending the conference that they were fed up with inadequate research about who was listening, about whether advertising on radio was effective in raising sales, and of being denied the opportunity to buy airtime on only one of the many split radio services around the country. David Lees, sales director of Capital Radio, Britain's largest and most successful station, said that better, more creative radio advertisements were needed. In order to achieve saturation coverage, the same radio advert was repeated too frequently. Several versions should be made so that listeners were not offended. Richard Eyre, recently appointed managing director of Capital Radio, said people under 25 had grown up with commercial radio and that there was reason for optimism and growth. Radio would be first to emerge from the recession, while ITV was losing its hold, especially as viewers zapped from channel to avoid advertisements. Maggie Brown in The Independent there.
In Electronic World News, Saab tests steer-by-wire. As part of a pan-European research programme into road safety technology, Saab Automobile is engaged in a study of active steering for cars. The steer-by-wire system is analogous to the fly-by-wire techniques now used in aircraft, and the Saab Automobile engineers are drawing on experience gained with aviation controls elsewhere in the Saab group. Saab believes that besides improving safety, active steering could make driving less stressful for the driver. Microprocessor control, which is already used in anti-lock braking and traction control systems, would assist the driver by being extended to directional control of the car. In active steering, sensors at the front and rear of the vehicle continually keep a microprocessor informed of the lateral and longitudinal forces acting on the car. The microprocessor compares the signals with the steering commands given by the driver, and the system ensures that the car will behave in the way the driver intends. There is no mechanical link between the driver and the car. In today's cars, the driver receives information feedback from the car through the steering wheel, when it's cornering, for example. Information is also conveyed to the driver through the seat, when the direction of the travel of the car changes. Saab's research is targeted at finding out how much and what type of information needs to be retrieved and transmitted to the driver. Active steering does not require the traditional steering column and steering wheel, because the driver's commands can be transmitted to the steering computer by any electronic means. At this stage of the research, Saab Automobile has adopted a joystick, again drawing on experience in the aircraft industry. Joystick control offers a number of advantages. By locating it to one side of the driver, car designers have complete freedom in laying out instruments and controls. They can be arranged in the most appropriate way, seeing as there is no steering wheel to conceal them. Safety is enhanced because there is no steering column that could be forced into the driver in a frontal collision. The steering characteristics can be adjusted to take account of different speeds. A movement of the joystick at low speeds causes greater travel of the steered wheels than it does at high speeds. Several functions have been duplicated. The joystick has two independent position sensors, one for the main microprocessor and one for the backup channel. A specially developed valve assembly with duplicated servo valves converts the electrical signal from the joystick to a hydraulic cylinder for the servo. When the system is started, it runs a built-in test routine that checks the safety logic and verifies that the system can be switched over to the backup channel and that the channel is fully operational. In addition, the test routine checks the information and warning logic from the electrical and hydraulic supply systems. Even if the research demonstrates that active steering offers real benefits, Saab Automobile still does not expect active steering to be introduced to production cars for several years to come. That's an intriguing story in Electronic World News.
It wouldn't take a long time to explain what lies between us.
This week on Sparks, Classic FM comes on air in the form of six low-power test stations. We've got a preview, and what chance does it have in the current radio environment? Plus a look at classical radio in America with compression and reverb. Hum a tune down the phone to your local library and they might think you strange. In Birmingham, they positively encourage it. PAL Plus side panel research is abandoned, and NHK in Japan broadcast HD TV, but who's watching? And a look at TV sets old and new. Steer-by-wire cars, Pirate FM, and Sinking Venice, all later on in Sparks today.
Sinking Venice to be saved with Thames Barrier Type Gates by Bruce Johnston. After years of wrangling, Venice's local government committee has unanimously agreed a scheme to save the city at a cost of billions of pounds. To launch the Progetto Insulae this year, nearly £1 billion has been made available over the next 2 years. Much of the cash will go towards defending the sinking city from the incursions of the sea, an essential prerequisite for any restoration plan. Immeasurable damage is caused by high tides, which frequently flood the lower floors of Venice's historic buildings. Later this year, work will start to raise, by more than a yard, seawalls and canal banks at 600 sites in the city, and at a further 100 sites in the lagoon town of Chioggia and on the islands of Murano and Burano. The second phase, requiring separate funding, is due to begin in 1994, when Thames Barrier-style gates, known as Moses Dykes, will be built at the lagoon's three entrances to the Adriatic to control potentially devastating high tides. Before 1994, another £230 million will be spent on efforts to rid Venice's often stinking lagoon from a second enemy, pollution. A project to clean the Brenta and Marzengo basins, which empty into the lagoon, will be aimed at halting the build-up of phosphates and hence the growth of algae, which in high temperatures and at low tides putrefy in the waters around Venice, producing a smell of rotten eggs. The chemical reaction of the putrefaction has at times been so severe that mirrors, tiles and silver have blackened overnight. Frescoes have suddenly faded, and the health of asthmatics, children and the elderly has been jeopardised. Nearly £200 million will go on dredging Venice's filthy canals, and £100 million will be spent on facelifts for buildings of historic interest, two universities and the airport. Until the decision at the end of a two-hour meeting of Venice's special interministerial local government committee, famous for its bickering to the point of being labelled living theatre, vital funds set aside some time ago by Parliament were unable to be used. Signor Giovanni Prandini, Minister of Public Works, beamed with satisfaction at the outcome. "I'm brimming with enthusiasm," he said. "Finally, we can proceed from the theoretical phase to that of intervention." Signor Giorgio Ruffolo, Minister of the fledgling Environment Department, said, "The project to save Venice is on the verge of takeoff. All we have to do is guide it." Why, after years of argument, wasted research and shelved plans, it took just 2 hours to decide to act on urgent recommendations that are already old is uncertain. One possibility is that recent tough decisions taken by Venice's council to curtail powerboat traffic from many canals so as to spare rotting foundations left an impression in Rome that Venice was now intent on saving itself. Government concern for Venice also increased after city elders allowed a Pink Floyd concert in St Mark's Square. Well, that was Bruce Johnston in the Daily Telegraph.
In electronic design, silicon bipolar ICs set a record of 30 gigabits per second. A group of researchers at the Ruhr University in Bochum in Germany set a speed record for semiconductor devices by developing silicon-based multiplexer and demultiplexer ICs that operate at over 30 gigabits per second. This is a record not only for silicon, but for any type of material. The new chips outperform even ICs using the more expensive gallium arsenide material, for which speeds of 28 gigabits per second have been reported, according to Hans-Martin Rein, a professor at the university's electrical engineering department and head of the research group. What's more, the silicon approach is not some exotic laboratory technique, but rather the kind that industry is now transferring into production. The Bochum feat again demonstrates silicon's usefulness in extremely fast semiconductor devices. At one time, experts predicted that it wouldn't be long before silicon would be replaced by gallium arsenide as a material in high-speed circuits. But researchers everywhere have kept pushing out the speed limits for the good old silicon, so often that experts have stopped predicting silicon's diminishing role. The ICs that the Bochum Group developed are intended for high-speed measuring equipment and future glass fiber transmission systems. One problem that the researchers faced was checking the extreme speed chips. As a solution, they built a pulse generator that could produce pulses at up to 30 gigabits per second, more than twice that of the fastest pulse generator on the market. A short piece of a report in Electronic Design about a world record-breaking bipolar silicon IC. Alan Farmer writes from Penicuik in Midlothian in Scotland. He's listening on both 3910 and 6205 with an ICOM ICR71A with a 76-foot dipole, which is 30 feet high and 900 feet above sea level. He's being 350 miles away from us and has hills 3 miles away to the north. Thanks to Alan Farmer for that report. And Peter Ruderink writes from Almere in the Netherlands. 3910 offers much better reception quality than 6205 and 12255. For your information, I'm 29 years old and I've just finished my PhD in physics, and I'm working at the Amsterdam laboratory of the Shell Oil Company. Looking forward to your answer. Meanwhile, tuning into the interesting programmes.
I'm sorry for upsetting the apple cart, but the news is bad on Easy Street. You and I have drifted apart, and it's never gonna be the same. Nowadays, they need people to blame, yeah.
to Cornwall and the new independent radio station, which is going to be called Pirate FM, being run by a chap called Mike Powell, who until recently was running County Sound in Guildford, until that rather unsuccessful operation was taken over by the more successful and aggressive Radio Mercury from Crawley. Cornwall's new independent radio station is to be known as Pirate FM. The station's name was revealed at a launch at the State House Hotel, Land's End. Cornwall Independent Radio Limited Chief Executive Mike Powell said the distinctive name and logo is going to become an integral part of Cornish life, so we are delighted that the new radio station will have a name that is not only fun, but which has such an obvious local connection. The station will be broadcasting from transmitters at Carradon Hill and Redruth on the frequencies 102.2 and 102.8. Pirate FM will, says Cornwall Independent Radio, be one of the most technically advanced in the world. I remember them saying the same thing about County Sound when they put that on the air. There will be computer-controlled music programming. Presenters will select and play items from computer keyboards rather than conventional control desks. The company will be pioneering new broadcasting hardware and software. Special jingles have been recorded in Dallas, Texas, by the same company responsible for BBC Radio 1 and 2's distinctive idents. Pirate FM is set to go on the air by Easter, but test transmissions will be going out by the end of March. And another item from the local newspaper, The Packet, about this operation: Pirate FM kidnaps rival's presenter, by a staff reporter. Cornwall's new radio station, Pirate FM, lived up to its name by kidnapping a star presenter from right under its rivals' noses. Popular DJ Duncan Warren was told to clear his desk after telling his bosses at BBC Radio Cornwall that he had accepted a job with the new commercial station due to go on the air in early April. Warren, whose 3 till tea programme was Radio Cornwall's most popular show, was waiting to be given a new contract by Radio Cornwall when the offer came from Pirate FM's chief executive Mike Powell. As his old contract had expired, he was a free agent, but offered to work another 2 weeks for Radio Cornwall so that they could make other arrangements. "I wanted to say goodbye to the listeners, but didn't get the chance," Warren told The Packet at Pirate FM's official launch at Land's End. "Now I've got people ringing up asking if I'm ill." He said there were no hard feelings towards BBC Radio Cornwall, where he had worked for 9 years, but the new station offered a fresh challenge that he found hard to resist. "Although I was offered an excellent deal to stay with the BBC, I felt that this is a most exciting development for radio in Cornwall, and I wanted to be part of it." The week before his departure, his show enjoyed record audience figures, and Warren hopes many of his fans will now tune into the new station. "We are going for 60s, 70s, 80s and melodic 90s music," said Warren, who will be Pirate's main daytime presenter. "Our aim is to appeal to a wide age range. Had we gone for funk or rap, we would be dead within a week." Pirate FM's boss said Warren was a bit of a superstar whose style would fit in well at the new station, which will be based in Poole near Camborne, with 2 transmitters carrying its news, information and music mix all over Cornwall and into West Devon. "We see ourselves as a reciprocal medium, not selling against the local press," said Mr. Powell. "We very much respect Radio Cornwall and hope to have friendly rivalry." The station's name was announced by a plane flying over Land's End trailing a banner. Then Mr. Powell played Pirate FM's upbeat theme tune, with its emphasis on future prosperity and success for Cornwall. "Presenters come and go," said the manager of BBC Radio Cornwall, Mike Hoskin. "He has been with us a long time. We regret him going, but presenters come and go. We shall soldier on," he said. Taking over from Warren on his Saturday Sounds Remembered programme will be the fire-eating, sometimes outrageous Freddie Zapp. He will put a little zap into the programme, said Mr. Hoskin. At the moment, Freddie divides his time between disc jockeying, serving on Redruth and Camborne town councils, and standing as a candidate for the Monster Raving Loony Party. During the weekdays, the afternoon programme, fronted by Warren, will be given over to Justin Lee, who has been Warren's deputy for some time. We shall be revamping, and he will be making it very much his programme, said Mr. Hoskin, the manager of BBC Radio Cornwall. Those stories from the Packet newspaper, sent in to us by George Williams from Redruth.
The Philips DC 777 car radio is a must for all serious shortwave listeners who spend time in the car. The Philips DC 777 packs a sophisticated shortwave tuner, AM/FM tuner and cassette player and powerful stereo amplifier into a standard size car radio unit. AM, FM and shortwave coverage from 3170 to 21910 continuous. The stereo cassette deck is also auto-reverse. Check out the review in the World Radio and TV Handbook, and it received 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shopping list. This top-of-the-range Philips car combination is available to Radiofax listeners at the special price of £249. Contact the Radiofax sales office by telephone in the UK on 0483 275997, or write for the brochure at Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, GU67BG in England.
Recently, we reported on the takeover of the Surrey and Hampshire station County Sound by Radio Mercury from Crawley in Sussex. The local newspaper has since been filled with letters of complaint about the Guildford station carrying the same programmes as Radio Mercury. Young, middle-aged and elderly will switch over, is the headline in the Surrey Advertiser. Dear Sir, I read with regret the demise of what was an independent local radio station, County Sound, which will undoubtedly happen by the axing of its spoken word and classical music programmes in favour of non-stop pop music. I appreciate some pop in the same way that I like classical music and features. A mix of programmes is what gives a radio station its individuality. The variety of music, features and Sunday religious programmes are not the prerogative of the older and too upmarket listeners. To quote, why should devotees of the myriad of pop programmes from other radio stations desert these in favour of non-proven, non-stop pop on County Sound? The young, middle-aged and elderly will all vote with their hands and find another spot on the dial and desert the revamped station. Doubtless the silenced contributions, excellent broadcasters all, will be heard on more enlightened stations. Their gain will be the sad loss of County Sound and its loyal listeners. They are the listenership that has the money to spend on what the advertisers want to sell. That from Elizabeth Rees from Sutton.
And James Thompson, also from Sutton, quality programmes like Hassler's Hour have vanished, and all-to-all pop seems to be what the policy is now. At least County Sound, as was attempted to be a quality local radio station, here is one ex-listener making a protest.
Alienated, from John Shorto in Guildford. Hassler's Hour is an informative programme, and apart from local news, is the only County Sound programme which interests me. I cannot see how the managing director of County Sound can hope to increase his audience by alienating his older listeners.
Foolish action, from Peter C. DeVale in Carshalton Beaches. Unless County Sound is made to realise how foolishly it has acted, it runs the risk of being dubbed County Unsound by those of us who have not sold our souls to the pop industry. Mr. DeVale is radio critic with The Times.
Wall-to-wall pop, from E. Castle in Guildford. Once the takeover by Mercury is complete, sadly, we too shall be swamped with the output most commercial stations now have to offer, wall-to-wall pop. The thinking audience of County Sound will switch off, and therefore it will, in the end, lose.
And from Margaret Key in Wanersh, there is no way BBC Radio Surrey will ever challenge us. How I disagree with this claim made by John O'Monier, the managing director of County Sound's parent company, as reported in last week's Lifestyle section. If, as Mr. O'Monier says, 71% don't listen to County Sound, who is to blame them? Maybe many of them would prefer to listen to BBC Radio Surrey.
From Jack Mulby in Guildford. Mr. O'Monier's remark that we don't do classical music well was offensive, to say the least, to the producer and presenter. Bob Symes always supported the local musical organisations, and many of us will miss the slot that gave such invaluable help in advertising the various concerts and events.
Letters in the Surrey Advertiser all complaining about the loss of County Sound, which incidentally is going to be put on AM only, losing their first gold service. It's funny how you don't really appreciate something until it disappears, isn't it? A letter from Norbert Scheel. A good decision to allow low-frequency shortwave channel during nighttime hours, enabling reception also in nearby areas, which during wintertime is being skipped by 6205, even at my location. 6205 has been skipped between mid and the end of November 91 until February 92. He's listening on 3910. One final remark about your programmes. Being a free radio pirate shortwave listener at weekends, I most enjoy your free radio documentaries, such as about RNI and Mebo 2, and also your oldie programmes, and your rock music programmes are also not bad. Wishing Radiofax continued success in the future. I remain yours in free radio. That's Norbert Scheel, who lives in Berlin, in Germany. And W. Black lives in St. Blasey in Cornwall, and he writes, I've been listening to your recent evening broadcasts with interest and thought you'd like to know how reception is. Although there is a certain amount of noise and interference, overall results are acceptable. No doubt this can be greatly improved, having a suitable aerial, but I've only just moved house and not been able to sort this out yet. By the way, my receiver is a Tatung TMR1602. It's always interesting to hear the various details you advise about frequencies, etc., from stations around the world. Thanks for that letter, Mr. Black. And if you'd like to write to us, the address is Sparks, Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG. If you'd like a reply, which includes a station card and technical information, also an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1. The address, Sparks, Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG. Next week on Sparks, Soundbase 3D surround sound. Hollywood is using it in some recent feature films, so is Kiss FM in London. But does it work? That's next week on Sparks.
Time after time. second hand unwind.
If you're lost, you can look and you will find me. Time after time, if you fall, I will catch you, I'll be waiting. Time after time, if you're lost, you can look and you will find me. Time after time, if you fall, I will catch you, I'll be
In international broadcasting, NHK hikes high-definition television airtime. But who's watching? Many believe high-definition television has all the makings of a jumbo jet without undercarriage. But NHK is convinced its regular analogue HD TV service will eventually take off. Paul Marks reports from NHK's Tokyo studios. Being first is often all that is needed to establish a de facto standard. Witness Rupert Murdoch's PAL-based Sky Television, which trounced BSB and its allegedly superior MAC packet delivery technology, chiefly by being first into the new DBS market. But the big difference between Sky and NHK's satellite-delivered 8-hour-a-day analogue high-definition service is that there is currently no market for high-definition, owing to the prohibitive set prices. Nevertheless, in November, a Japanese kabuki dance program kicked off the world's first scheduled high-definition service. Broadcast via the BS-3B satellite, the one put into orbit after the BS-3H craft was blown to pieces on launch last April, the high-vision transmissions will only be received at 100 sites throughout Japan, including leisure centres, shopping malls, museums, and the occasional very wealthy household. TV shop owners say that the price, around £17,000, for high-vision receivers are an impossible outlay for most Japanese, and NHK, along with its co-broadcasters in the High Vision Promotion Association, are under no illusions that these test transmissions will magically create some kind of mass market. The most the Promotion Association hopes for is that the tests will contribute to the popularisation and further development of High Vision as a broadcast standard. But, bland assertions aside, most unblinkered folk involved know that high-definition television will only truly take off when viewers can hang receivers on a wall and not have to kick out their door frames to get a high-definition tube into their home. Engineers at NHK have successfully demonstrated a 14-inch plasma panel colour display, but the holy grail of a widescreen flat display is still a long way off. Even Sharp's new flat-screen 4:3 TV is only the size of a laptop computer screen. NHK believes it will take the likes of Matsushita, Sony and Toshiba 5 or 6 years to get even tube-based consumer HD TV set prices down to what is believed to be the consumer-friendly level of 1 million yen, or £4,300. In the meantime, it hopes that program originality will capture hearts and minds and generate a supermassive black hole of latent consumer demand, which will hopefully suck in HD TV sets when the price is right. Outside Japan, the six-way testing process currently being undertaken by the USA's FCC has angered NHK. Shiba of NHK told International Broadcasting he is very surprised to have heard FCC executives publicly saying that a digital system is a preferred solution before Narrow Muse, the bandwidth-limited high-vision analog encoding method, had even been tested. Narrow Muse uses entirely digital routines in signal processing whilst pushing out an analog transmission. Certainly, the noises from the United States are that an all-digital system will be chosen, and the US press, notably Newsweek, is currently running stories on how the digital American tortoise has caught up with the analog Euro-Japanese hare, which has up to now been running away with the HD TV trophies. Given that NHK got a very strong request from the FCC and the National Association of Broadcasters to enter Narrow Muse in the HDTV race, the company is feeling particularly hard done by. That said, Sheba confirmed that NHK researchers are working on many different all-digital HDTV transmission systems for possible implementation sometime in the next 10 to 20 years. Regarding Europe's HDTV efforts, Sheba is complimentary, but verges on the dismissive at times. Last summer, at the Mozart Festival in Salzburg, Austria, the Magic Flute was recorded in high vision on Sony 1-inch digital VTRs and on the Eureka VTR. Most people said 1125 lines was better than 1250. With a rate of 50 against our 60 fields per second, the flicker was less on high vision, says Sheba. People I spoke to in the Eureka project agreed that they were behind Japan by 5 to 6 years, he added. But does Sheba foresee Europe following the one-hour-a-day test transmission route established by NHK before the recent hike to 8 hours? In order to conduct 1 hour a day, they must be very well prepared. They are clearly not ready and are not yet near that stage, though at the Montreux Electronic Cinema Festival, Eureka showed some excellent high-definition programs. The difference between them and us in Japan is that Eureka has not yet developed the complete high-definition broadcasting chain. That was Paul Marks in International Broadcasting.
On BBC World Service, a programme looking at the early days of television, including a look at an interesting television set on show at the Science Museum, where the picture tube looked like the bottom of a wine bottle.
This is the BBC television station at Alexandra Palace. At 3 o'clock this afternoon, the television service was opened by the Postmaster General using the Baird system. The opening programme will now be repeated on the Marconi EMI system.
And back on the gallery at the Science Museum, we have one of the first mass-produced television receivers in front of us. This must have been the sort of thing that many people would have watched those early test transmissions on, Roger.
Yes, this is a Pi vision-only receiver of 1938. It's vision-only just to cut the cost down. You could pick up the television sound on your ordinary radio on the shortwave band. And this has a tiny screen. It's only about 5 inches. It's round, and it looks exactly like the bottom of a bottle. I don't know how anybody ever watched a picture on it, because there's a huge bump in the middle where it was made, just like a bottle. But even so, it would have cost the equivalent in modern values of about £1,500. It was a very expensive acquisition indeed, if you could afford to buy one. Of course, within a year, the television service had closed down anyway. If after the war you could dig out this set and dust it down and get it going, it would still have worked. The transmission frequencies hadn't changed, so this would still have worked. And you could have watched the Victory Parade outside broadcast, which opened up the service in 1946.
And next, to the present day, to the BBC's research department at Kingswood Warren in Surrey.
Ian, the great television set in front of us, showing a very, very clear picture. The first thing I noticed about it is it's not even the same shape picture as most televisions we're used to.
No, that's quite true. One of the things that we've found during tests is the bigger the screen gets and the more it fills your field of view, the more value you get from making it wider rather than higher. The big question here is how large a television set people would like in their homes. We've done some tests with flat photographs, simulating flat screens. And the indication is that provided the set doesn't come in a big box, people would like a picture which is about a metre diagonal or so. It probably comes as no great surprise that if we're doubling the size of the screen approximately, we're talking approximately about doubling the number of lines. And in fact, the standard that we're looking at now has got 1250 lines rather than 625, and it's exactly double the number of lines. However, that's only half the story, because if we double the resolution vertically, we also need to double the resolution along each line. And so the bandwidth of the signal that we're recording is not just doubled, it is multiplied by four. to give this four times information content, twice vertically and twice horizontally.
It would, however, help if everyone used the same system. Already, Europe uses 625 lines, America 525. Britain uses the PAL system to encode colour. France uses CCAM. Satellites introduce yet more options, such as GMAC, and the Japanese are developing a different high-definition system from the European one. If anything is going to be able to handle the differences and bring the price down, it's the ever-evolving silicon chip, the subject of next week's programme.
Martin Redfern there on the programme It Made Our World, making a slip saying GMAC, when of course he means DMAC, about satellites, and before that interviewing Ian Childs, head of television research at BBC's research department. That was from World Service.
You're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts, and a letter from John Wilson. I'm a newcomer to the world of shortwave and was fiddling around on my set a Sony ICF SW800 using the AN61 long wire antenna when I picked up your Sparks program on 6205. Your program was very interesting to someone interested in technology, especially the section about DCC and mini-disc, and also the section about new sorts of television. Reception was clear on 6205. I hope you will continue to broadcast without a hitch, and I shall be tuning in on Monday nights from now on. Long live Pirate Radio. Well, hear, hear, John Wilson, thanks for that letter, and here's another report about DCC mini disc, etc.
The Radio 4 programme, You and Yours, interviewed Simon Hind from the Consumers Association about the forthcoming digital audio standards.
What do you think is going to happen in terms of which format gains supremacy?
Well, it's almost impossible to say. I mean, the analogy that people often make is with what happened with video recorders a few years ago when we had VHS, Beta and V2000. Different people had different players. You couldn't swap the cassettes between different players. A very confusing time. In the end, one format, VHS, won out. Now, it didn't win out because it was the best format by any means. The reason it won out was because the manufacturers persuaded the people who make the films to release their films primarily on VHS cassette, and that's really what's going to dictate which of these formats wins, where the record companies jump. Will they go for DCC? Will they go for DAT, digital audio tape, which has been around for a while but is still an important format, or will they go for mini disc? And that will ultimately decide which format gains supremacy.
Do we have any idea which way they will jump, or do you think for a while anyway they'll put out their music on the whole range of different formats?
We'd quite like to see that, yes. I mean, it's important to bear in mind that the record companies fairly recently got into compact disc. It's in the last few years, and the technology involved in setting up recordings on compact disc has cost them a lot of money, so they may not want to invest a huge amount of money in new format. They'll wait and see. They'll try and get a feel for which way the market's going. This market is always led by the sort of hi-fi buffs, the kind of people who will go out and buy these things as soon as they appear on the market, and you get some kind of feel fairly early on for which one is the most popular. The record companies will take soundings, and eventually I imagine they'll try and get together and decide on one format rather than record company A doing one thing, record company B doing another thing.
What does seem very appealing is the fact that with the digital compact cassettes you will still be able to play your old tapes on them.
That's absolutely right. That's a particularly important point. I mean, the two things about these new formats: one is that they allow you to record, which is very important, which clearly you can't do with compact disc, and you can record to very high quality. But it will be attractive undoubtedly for people who've got, say, big cassette collections to know that they aren't going to be obsolete, that they'll still be able to use those cassettes on the new players, and that's a big plus for this format.
And also for those who like top quality sounds in their cars, will DCC be the one to go for them as well?
DCC or possibly mini-disc or even DAT. I mean, we really will have to wait and see. I mean, for most people, I think these new formats will take the place of cassettes. So, like a few years ago, we'd probably have a record player and a cassette player. In 10 years' time, people will have a compact disc player and one other format.
Simon Hind of the Consumers Association, thank you very much indeed.
That was BBC Radio 4, You and Yours.
Well, it could be a long battle between DCC and Minidisc, because DCC is backed by Philips, who also are associated with EMI and all those record companies, and Sony now owns CBS and Columbia, so they're going to be backing the Minidisc.